Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 325 for July 17th, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
Can you imagine from two pot fills? Well, a whole town seems to have grown up around us. Improvements everywhere. We employ so many people. And I personally, I have a new house. A house with two rooms, if you can imagine.
The town of Oban on Scotland's west coast is celebrating its 200th anniversary this week, and the folks at Oban Distillery have cranked up the old time machine. That's Alan Stevenson, a cousin of the distillery's founders, John and Hugh Stevenson, and he's made the jump from 1823 or so to help mark the anniversary. More with Alan later, along with the team that helped make Alan's leap in time possible. I'll also have the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First off, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, and let's start off with a Whiskey Cast exclusive. After years of begging and pleading, American whiskey lovers may soon be able to get Nika's Japanese whiskeys in the U.S. I've learned from a very reliable source that Asahi Group Holdings, Nika's owner, has now selected a U.S. importer and distributor and is working on making Nika's whiskeys available in the U.S. There is no set time frame, though. Keep in mind that the U.S. Treasury Department's Tax and Trade Bureau has to sign off on all whiskeys to be imported into the U.S., including lab analysis and the all-important label approval process. That can take a while, especially when the distillers want to use the term single malt whiskey on the label. As we've heard before here on Whiskey Cast, there is no specific language in U.S. code that allows the use of the term single malt whiskey on any whiskey produced outside Scotland, Ireland, or Canada, and that's part of the reason Nika has not exported to the U.S. in the past. The regulations were last updated in 2000, well before the growth in single malt whiskey production in other countries. I'll keep you posted on Nika's status as I get more details. Also on that front, I've been told that the U.S. importer for Sullivan's Cove whiskies from Australia has now submitted samples for lab analysis and is hoping to have its whiskies in the States in time for the holidays. Meanwhile, it looks like we have a new number one in world whiskey sales. For years, Jack Daniel's has been regarded as the world's best-selling whiskey brand, but a new report from Drinks International and Euromonitor on the world's top-selling drinks brands ranks Johnnie Walker as the best-selling traditional whiskey brand, with 15.9 million cases sold in 2010. That compares to 9.95 million for Jack. And here's why I say traditional whiskey brands. Johnnie Walker is in a cluster around 10th place with four whiskeys from India: Bagpiper, Officer's Choice, McDowell's No. 1, and McDowell's No. 1 Celebration. Now, those whiskeys are all made with molasses, which is legal in India and a point of contention everywhere else. Most countries consider those to be more like rums. There were 172 entries in what Drinks International refers to as the Millionaire's Club, brands with sales of at least 1 million 9-liter cases a year. Johnnie Walker ranks 9th on the list, followed by Jack Daniel's at 21st. Ballantine's is 34th, Jim Beam 38th, followed closely by Crown Royal and Grant's in 39th and 40th places, respectively. J&B Rare is 43rd, followed by Chivas Regal at 47th, Dewar's at 61st, Jameson at 62nd, Suntory's Kakubin Japanese Whiskey at 73rd, William Peel and Bell's at 76th and 77th, and Seagram's Seven Crown in 80th place. Black Velvet Canadian Whiskey is 93rd, followed by Canadian Club at 97th and Teacher's Highland Cream at 99th. Clan Campbell Scotch is 108th, followed by Canadian Mist at 110th. Black Nika from Japan is at 112th. Pernod Ricard's 100 Pipers Scotch is at 113th. Bacardi's William Lawson's Scotch is at 116th. Diageo's Buchanan's Scotch is at 128th. Evan Williams Bourbon is at 140th, followed by Seagram's VO at 146th. Sir Edward's Scotch at 149th. Beam's DYC from Spain is 153rd. Clan MacGregor from Grants is at 157th. High Commissioner Scotch is at 163rd. followed by Maker's Mark, new to the list, at 169th, and Windsor Canadian at 170th. Now, did you notice anything interesting about this list? There's not one single malt whiskey anywhere on it. Every single one of the Scotch whiskies on the list is a blended Scotch. By the way, number one on the list is Jinro Soju from South Korea, with sales last year of 64 million cases, nearly triple that of number two Smirnoff Vodka, with 24.3 million cases. Speaking of vodka for just a second, authorities in Great Britain had been warning consumers about an epidemic of counterfeit vodka being sold as the real thing in the Lincolnshire area. It's unfortunately now pretty clear where the fake stuff may have been coming from. An explosion at an industrial estate in Boston this week killed five men and critically burned a sixth. Police have found evidence of an illegal distillery in the rubble. Three of the victims have been identified as Lithuanian nationals. Police are still trying to identify the other victims, including the one survivor. In other news, I've received official confirmation now of something Matt Wooler posted on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page a few days ago. The organizers of Whiskey Live Sydney have decided to postpone this year's event, scheduled for October. They're hoping to expand to multiple cities in Australia next year. No reason was given for the postponement. Let's switch to some more positive news now. There's a new Blackadder release coming to market. Pete Reek is a single cask bottling from an undisclosed Isla distillery. It's been bottled at 46% ABV and will be available in Europe and the U.S. Also, Blackadder Smoking Isla will soon be available in the U.S., along with several other Blackadder single cask bottlings from Tullibardine, Tobermory, Bowmore, Kalila, Laphroaig, and McAllen distilleries. Also coming to the U.S., McKinley's Old Rare Highland Malt Whiskey. Of course, it's better known as Shackleton's Whiskey, and is the White and Mackay recreation of the whiskey left behind in Antarctica for more than a century after Sir William Shackleton's unsuccessful attempt to reach the South Pole. White and Mackay confirms that a U.S. version is in transit now and should be available at retailers sometime in August. Ardbeg Alligator made its debut during Fagil, and then as a bottling for Ardbeg committee members. Now the rest of us mere mortals will be able to get it. David Blackmore of Glenmorangie and Ardbeg says it'll be available in September.
You'll be pleased to know it's exactly the same juice as the committee release. Of course, there'll be a slightly more availability of the regular Alligator release. Can't say exactly the quantities, but there'll be a bit more than the committee.
And for the folks who are not aware of what the Alligator was and is, just explain it real quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the concept with a lot of the Ardbeg releases leading back to our sort of limited stock profile, I suppose, from the inheritance of the distillery in 97, is that we use a sort of a base of Ardbeg 10-year-old Asian American white oak barrels and liquid similar to that, and then we'll play off that and create different flavor profiles by using small packets of Ardbeg that's been aged in other types of casks. So with the Alligator, the majority of the liquid is very similar to the Ardbeg 10-year-old, with a smaller packet of whiskey to change the whole nature of the Alligator that's been aged in these heavily charred cask, American white oak casks, and the Alligator refers to an alligator char. So when you burn a cask to that level or char the inside of it, the actual charring starts to split apart and looks like a sort of an alligator skin. It's really quite fascinating. Yeah.
And I wanted to talk to you real quickly on the Glenmorangie side. No new whiskeys coming out now, but you have an interesting promotion going with the distillery itself. Back in Tain, right?
Yeah. So in the last year or so, we've been doing some redesigning and redeveloping of our visitors center. And one of the things we've built into the new visitor center is a wall. And look out for the current bottlings, the newest bottling of the Glenmorangie 18-year-old. You'll see that around the outside of the gold gift box is a little sleeve. Take that off and look inside the packaging, and you'll see there's a couple of little postcards in there. And the promotion is that you send those in, and we'll be picking 1,843, so 1843, our foundation date, 1,843 names, which will then be engraved into one of the walls of our visitor center moving forward for posterity, your name can be part of the distillery.
Until the next renovation, right?
You never know. Maybe we'll leave. I think we should probably leave that for a good while.
I was being facetious, yeah. Of course, but this gives people a chance to have their name at the distillery in a way that I don't think anybody else has done something like this.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never heard of anything else like it. I'm very upset. I'm not allowed to partake. I'd like to have my name on there as well, but being an employee, I'm not allowed. But it's a great opportunity.
When will the visitor center be completed on the renovation side for the folks who do want to get up to Tain?
I think pretty much it's done, and it's just the wall that's we're waiting for the names. That when that project's done, the whole thing's done, as far as I know.
And for those who might want to make the trip, Tain really isn't that hard to get to, as I found out visiting another nearby distillery, but driving right by Glenmorangie on the way, it really isn't that hard to get to from Inverness. It's not a remote location.
No, it's not. You know, you look at it on a map of Scotland and you think, hell, gosh, that's in the middle of nowhere. It's going to be icebergs and polar bears and things next. And really, it isn't that remote. Often people say, well, you know, Glenmorangie, it's all up there by itself. And if you want to make it part of a tour, we are close to several other well-known distilleries. So I'd encourage you to get out of Speyside and come up and see us lot up in the Highlands, definitely. And definitely come and see Glenmorangie. It's a great place. And if you've never been and seen the Glenmorangie still room, you're in for an awe-inspiring experience. It's really a cathedral to distilling, the tallest stills in Scotland. Pretty amazing.
And the actual town of Tain is not a bad little town. I got the chance to spend a little time walking around Tain. It really is a very beautiful little historic town.
Yeah, it's a great place, and there's lots of there's even a couple of really good art galleries in town. Nice beach, plenty of old buildings to go around. A couple of good old fashioned Scottish pubs with a couple of old guys sat there all day and all night. It's a good place. Yeah, and if you're a golfer, you know we've got even Tain Links is a great course, but Royal Dornoch. Right on our doorstep, and then of course couldn't forget the Glenmorangie House, just outside of Tain, which is our private country house hotel, open to the public at weekends throughout the year. Really fantastic opportunity to you know, I know lots of people that have stayed there that have also been to some of the other distilleries, country house hotels, and they've always said, you know, Glenmorangie just know how to do it. It's a great place.
By the way, David has been promoted to Global Brand Ambassador for Glenmorangie, and he's also now part of the company's whiskey-making team led by Dr. Bill Lumsden. He's taking over for Annabel Meikle, who has returned to the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society to run the Society's main venue in Leith. I was at a Knob Creek Bourbon Media event the other night in New York City and caught up with Bernie Lubbers, Knob Creek's resident whiskey professor. Bernie's getting ready for Tales of the Cocktail this week in New Orleans, and if you're planning to be there, he'll probably have a few copies of his new book with him.
How is the book going?
Well, thanks for asking, Mark. This is Bourbon Whiskey, Our Native Spirit, which is a book that came out in right around May. It's doing great. I checked yesterday, and only two copies were left on Amazon. I'm sure they got more in the back, you know, but they listed only two left. Friend of mine bought the book in Louisville at Carmichael's bookstore and bought the last copy, so they'll have to reorder. So I think it's going real well.
And they're going to have to reorder because you're doing a signing later this month,
right?
There, right?
That's right. July 26th at 7 o'clock, I'm going to do a signing in Carmichael's bookstore on Frankfort Avenue in Louisville. Also be doing a little bit of a bourbon tasting there as well, so it'll be a lot of fun.
And you've also started a blog, too, separately from the Whiskey Professor site, right?
Yeah. I've started whiskeyprof.com. That's with one F. And it's kind of, you know, different, my take on different things. You know, it's just a blog. It's a lot of fun. It's kind of bare bones right now, but as you know, it'll fill up pretty quickly because next week's Tales of the Cocktail, which I'll be out at as well down there.
And for those who have not been to Tales of the Cocktail, this is... I've not been down myself because the thought of going to New Orleans in July when it's 95 degrees, 90% humidity drives me absolutely insane. But this sure is sort of the big event of the year for anybody who's into cocktails, right?
Oh, my gosh. The leading mixologist, the leading bar owners and managers, the cocktail enjoyers are down there. A lot of media folks. And yeah, I mean, I'm from Kentucky, so I'm used to, you know, 90% humidity and 90 degrees. So, you know, so what's a few more degrees and a few more humidity for me? But the but yeah, pack your shorts, and you just need a backpack is all you need, because you're gonna wear shorts and you're gonna drink the whole time. That's where I love having my my old granddad Bloody Marys down there at the Chart Room. It's just a great time. You need to get down there sometime, and everybody else needs to come down there too.
I'm going to go, but I have to hydrate with cold beer down there. It's after living in Houston for a few years, I know the drill, but it's just bloody hot down there.
Oh, my gosh. And they got plenty of Beta beer down there, so you'll be fine.
What can people find down at Tails?
You can learn a lot. You know, that's the main thing. It's not just a drink fest for a bunch of bartenders. These are not just bartenders either, Mark. These are the top mixologists, not only from around the country, but there's going to be guys there from Germany, Sweden, Australia. Our folks from Australia come in. So these are the people who want to make mixology a career, and they're real serious about it. So you can learn a lot. There's different classes during the day. And sure, there's a lot of imbibing. Sure, there's a lot of that. But how else do you do that research? But when you get to drink with the top writers and journalists, the top mixologists, and then folks like ambassadors like myself, Fred Noe, Jimmy Russell, Parker Beam's going to be down there. You can really learn from the horse's mouth, because, you know, the folks like Parker Beam, in his 70s, he's not going to be around, 20 years from now. So what an excellent chance to be able to talk to folks like that.
Okay, you sold me. Next year I'll go.
Okay, well, I'll see you down there. You know, a couple Tommy Bahama shirts, shorts, and you'll be fine.
Tales of the Cocktail starts this Wednesday and runs through the weekend. The forecast is for thunderstorms every day and temperatures around 90. By the way, Top Chef veteran Mike Isabella was cooking with Knob Creek that night. You'll be able to see what he was whipping up on the next episode of WhiskeyCast HD. Watch for it in the next few days. That's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. Let's check the comments of the week now, brought to you this time around by Highland Park. Got a great email and a photo from Christopher Winters in Indiana this week. Hi, Mark. Just thought I'd send you a photo of my new home bar. We just built the house and moved in 1 month ago. As you can see, it's mostly a whiskey bar with over 150 different bottles. It is the best place to be in the house. It is right off the kitchen. Next time you're back home in Indiana, feel free to stop by. My only problem now is that I don't have any grass at the new place, and I always listen to WhiskeyCast while mowing the grass. What to do? Well, that's easy. Listen while you're planting the grass. I'll post the photo on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. Christopher did a great job with this bar. And if you're planning a home improvement project soon, well, this might give you some ideas. Lots of feedback on the last episode with the very outspoken Gordon Bruce of Knockdo. Gavin Ryan Thompson in Germany posted this on the Facebook wall. Just finished listening to this week's Different But in a Good Way podcast, to which I had to laugh and smile a good few times. What a way to start a Sunday morning. First of all, the song from the Whiskey for Breakfast album was brilliant. The lyrics are just perfect. I'll be ordering this CD and will play it during my whiskey tastings that I host for my friends at home. Gordon Bruce from Knockdo Distillery was effin' awesome. Counted 9 swear words, which I think was pretty good for a half an hour interview. I think he held back a little there. As I'm a pure Scotsman living in Germany, it's good to hear the Scots tongue and a good bit of banter. Keep up the good work, Slanja. And Rajan Talwar posted this note from India. This week's episode from Knockdo was the best yet. The interview with Gordon was original, informative, and amusing. I had a smile on my face the whole time. The spontaneity was evident in Gordon's soft-spoken tongue. Loved the bit about NFG and NFI. Thank you, Rajan, and if you haven't heard last week's episode for yourself and don't know what NFG and NFI mean, well, you're going to have to listen to Gordon's explanation for yourself. By the way, Gordon is featured in the latest episode of WhiskeyCast HD. You'll be able to see some of the things he told us about during the tour, and it is safe for family viewing. Hey, I'd love to hear from you. You can always share your comments or questions at the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, or just email me. My address is comments@whiskeycast.com. The emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Highland Park.
Hello, this is Jerry Tosh of Highland Park, the makers of the best spirit in the world. If you'd like to go onto the WhiskeyCast website and click on the banner, then it'll take you to the inner circle and sign up, and we'll send you as much information about Highland Park as you'd ever need to know.
Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you as always by Laphroaig. Just got word about the Whiskey Rebellion Festival coming up at the end of the month in Washington, Pennsylvania. The David Bradford House Museum is named for one of the leaders of the Whiskey Rebellion. Rob Samuels of Maker's Mark will be the guest of honor at this year's Whiskey Rebellion Dinner at the George Washington Hotel on July 29th. Tickets are still available. You can contact Trip Klein for details. He can be reached at area code 412-916-0187. That's 412-916-0187. The weekly Wednesday night tastings at the Commercial Hall in Dufton, Scotland continue this week with an Angus Dundee tasting, followed by Inverhouse Distillers on the 27th and Glenfarclas on August 3rd. The Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's Australian chapter will hold a Winter Burns Dinner on July 28th in Melbourne. Remember, it's the middle of winter down under. Bonhams will hold its next whiskey auction on August 17th in Edinburgh, and Laphroaig's John Campbell will be the guest of honor at the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's vaults in Leith, Scotland on August 31st. Those are just some of the events coming up over the next few weeks. You'll find a full calendar at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Become a friend of Laphroaig today and claim your own square foot of Isla. This week on WhiskeyCast In Depth, we're looking at the town of Oban on Scotland's west coast. The town has been celebrating its 200th anniversary all week long. Oban grew up around its distillery, which was founded back in 1794 by John and Hugh Stevenson as a brewery. While a lot of the details from those days have been lost, the distillery decided to celebrate this week's anniversary by going back into time. The Diageo time machine came back with Alan Stevenson, a cousin of John and Hugh, who worked at the distillery around 1823 as a coal shoveler. I talked with Alan this week, along with the folks in charge of the time machine.
What you need to imagine is that, you know, when my cousins Hugh and John came here, there was nothing much here at all. A few wee crofts and just the wee bay. And that's how Oban got its name. Oban means small bay. But they started off here with a brewery, but it didn't work out. So what they did was they changed to whiskey production. And we're grateful that they did. And with that came wealth. Can you imagine from two pot stills? Well, a whole town seems to have grown up around us. Improvements everywhere. We employ so many people. And I personally, I have a new house. Aye, a house with two rooms, if you can imagine. Two rooms for just me, my wife, and our five bairns. So without the brewery, I don't think there'd have been much here. But, you know, it has grown up into a magnificent town in the time that we've been here.
And the time we're talking about is approximately 1823. Tell me about the distillery.
I beg your pardon?
Tell me about the distillery as it exists in 1823.
Well, we have the two pots here, and we have large furnaces under the pots to heat it. What we're doing, obviously, is as the whiskey distilling process goes through, we'll take our mash initially and heat it, and then we'll get it higher than the heating of alcohol, take off the vapor and cool it. And we'll do that several times to distill in order to get our whiskey. Now, the whiskey we get here is the best whiskey on the whole of the West Coast. The color, the aroma is something extraordinary. But that, you see, is what you get from having a legal still. We are one of the very, very few licensed distilleries in the whole of Scotland. Now, we have what we call free traders about. Now, the free traders, they have their illegal stills, and they'll trade against their rent or against goods. But the whiskey's no good. It's not properly distilled. It's rough. It shouldn't be called whiskey at all. In fact, it is against the law, and we could get the gauge men on, in on them, and there'd be trouble for everyone. I personally will have no truck with free traders. I mean, we might be a small brewery here, but as I said, we're legal, and we produce quality.
How much were you producing back in 1823?
How much were you producing in 1823? Oh, God, I can't tell you, really. I mean, we're producing barrel load by barrel load. I mean, we're very efficient. We've at least 20 guys on the furnaces, you know, shoveling away, and we're getting all our crops in from the roundabout. In fact, we're having to extend our crop purchase further and further because we're using everything up, our barley. Yes. I hope that helps.
And your function at the distillery was to shovel coal, and one of those guys that's shoveling coal to keep the stills going, right?
That's correct, sir. But you see, as I am a distant cousin, I do feel that I am somewhat relied upon just to keep the other men in check. I will not stand for any slacking, that's for sure. I make sure that all is done tip-top, keep a nice tight ship, so I do. And that's my job, to see that everything goes well. Because, you see, it's really important that we keep the temperature constant and correct. You can't just be taking your eye off things and having a wee blether and then finding out that everything has gone wrong or your furnace has gone out. There'd be hell to pay if that happened.
Where were you shipping this whiskey off to after it was made? Was a lot of it being shipped down to England? Was it being sent into Scotland? Where was it going?
Well, a lot of it went to England, indeed, sir, a lot of it went to England, but obviously we have our own market. But, you see, the situation is such that with the malt taxes being so high, that we couldn't always afford to sell it to our own Scots people. So some would be distributed throughout Scotland, but, you see, there's always been, as I say, a tradition of making whiskey in one's own home, which is now illegal. And obviously, as I say, it's not as good as the whiskey we make, but it is predominantly for an English market.
Tell me about life in Oban, the town itself.
Well, you see, you've got to imagine how things are very new here. If you can imagine that there was just, as I say, nothing here. But now, we have the farmland out without further on, but we've got a small town built up, but everything is brand new. It's clean, if you can imagine. There's no rotting buildings around here. Everything is spanking new. It's fresh. We're right on the coast. I mean, there's food out in the bay. We can catch as many fish as we like. And we've got plenty of whiskey coming from the brewery. So we're all very happy in one way or another. Good, clean living. That's what you've got here. And, of course, we've got a brilliant church and a wonderful minister, which keeps us all on the straight and narrow. In fact, we get every other Sunday off so we can be in the kirk.
Let's move the time machine forward a couple of hundred years now and bring you back to real world. Your real name, of course, is Liam Calgi, and you're portraying Alan Stevenson at the distillery this week. Tell me about the research that went into putting your presentation together.
Well, the research was predominantly from the archive, which was given to the playwright Ceddie Dixon Spain. And then what Ceddie also did is she has done extensive investigation into how whiskey has played an integral part of Scottish life throughout the ages. There's many productions that the Walking Theatre Company does that are to do with clearances and whiskey and smuggling, which were obviously right at the heart of Scotland. So you need to look at how people lived. I mean, as we've said before in the previous interview, people used to barter this. So they would make their own whiskey and barter it for their rent. And if they could get 10 shillings a week, they'd be able to pay their rent, keep their family, keep a cow, keep a horse. Now, all of those were essential to their way of life. If you had a cow, you had milk, and eventually come the winter, you'd also have meat. So this was a big part of people's life, and obviously they would use it within the home in many different ways other than just to drink, but that's another story entirely.
Such as? I know they'd use it for cooking, wetting the heads of newborns, things like that.
Well, I mean, you might also use it as an anesthetic for if you've got a sore tooth or something like that. So, you know, it did have many uses for cleansing things. I mean, it would be, you know, you could wash your table down with it, and it would be germ-free, as you still could today. But what a waste of wonderful whiskey that would be.
That's where we get that lemon furniture polish smell that we occasionally get in whiskeys, I guess.
I guess so, yeah.
Thank you very much, Liam. I appreciate it. We're talking with Joanne McCutcher, one of the Diageo archivists now. And Joanne, tell me first of all about the research that went into helping Liam put together a very entertaining and a very historically accurate presentation of life back in 1823 or so in Oban.
What we did was we were approached by the distillery to help them celebrate the 200th anniversary of Oban Town. And we started by looking through the records that we have at the Diageo archive to help them sort of get together some information about distilling at the time, Oban at the time, and how the distillery grew. And we then used that information to feed into the event. So we obviously helped write with the script, to help them to write the script, but we also have brought items from the Diageo archive to Oban Distillery itself, and we have a small display here that we'll be showing over the next couple of days.
Such as, what's in that display?
So what's in the display, we've got, basically we've taken a sample from the Diageo archive collection to illustrate the whisky industry in Scotland throughout the years. So we have production records dating from the 1890s. We've got things like the barley purchase book that would have been used, and then a compare book taking you through to the stock records, and then also some staff records. We also have a distillery visitors book from Talisker Distillery. And we've had to open the remit up slightly so that it's not just Oban specific. So we have records of Johnny Walker as well. So we have a nice reel of Johnny Walker historical adverts that we're showing. And we also have some point of sale items for Johnny Walker that have been branded over the years. And they date from around the 1920s to the 1950s. And we have some nice staff photographs as well. And we also have a beautiful Johnny Walker decanter that would have sat on a bar at one point and been used to serve the whiskey from, that we've brought from the archive for the display as well. So it's quite a lot of things on two very big tables.
Tell me about the history of Oban, the distillery, because as we've said, it predates the beginning of the town. The town literally grew up around the distillery, right?
Yes, that's right. So the distillery was established in 1794, and the town very much grew up around the distillery, which is why Oban is quite unique, because it really is bang smack in the centre of the town. And it just developed over the years and grew and grew.
And how has it changed over the years? Obviously, they've expanded since the Stevensons built the original facility, but what all has been done to expand the distillery over the years?
Well, the distillery hasn't so much expanded as changed, I would say. So we no longer have a maltings on site that's now used for the Distillery Visitor Centre, and there is no longer a cooperage on site that's done elsewhere. So those sorts of those parts of the whisky distilling process, I would say, have now been outsourced to larger parts. So the distillery now is very much focused on the production of the spirit. So it's a beautiful little place, quite a quaint distillery, but you know, with just two stills. They've got a lovely visitor centre that you can come in and you get a very, very good tour. So I would say the sort of focus of the distillery has changed in some ways, in that, you know, we're not so much doing everything on one site, but the spirit is still being made, the liquid is still being made, and it's now being much more accessible to the public.
And let's talk about the archives, because your archives at Diageo go back to the old DCL and Distillers Company Limited.
Yeah,
and go back,
further back
literally to almost the beginning of the Scotch whisky industry, right?
Yeah, so we have records in the archives that date back over 403 years. So we are responsible for looking after the historical records for all Diageo brands and all Diageo markets. So there's a team of four professional archivists that work there full time, and we are situated just outside Stirling, and we've got two very large warehouses that are full of records dating, as I say, from the beginning of Bushmills right the way up to the new Diageo innovation products that are being launched today, and obviously the newer products that have taken off, like Baileys, which in terms of Diageo is still quite a baby brand because it was just launched in 1974. So we are looking after the historical but also collecting the current. So this enables us to build the collections of the future. So it's not just whiskey as well. We also look after all Diageo brands, but obviously the whiskey side of things does take up, I would say, about 50% of the collection.
Do you have historical records for all of the distilleries and everything that DCL had, all the closed and mothballed distilleries too?
Yes, we do. So there is the distillery records and also a DCL collection as well. So between the two, you tend to be able to find what you're looking for.
Is this open to researchers? If someone's writing a book or doing some historical research, is it possible to actually get a look inside the archives?
Yes, it is. Yes, we are. I mean, we don't have, we're not open to the public, so you couldn't just turn up. The archive in the way that we're set up is that we're just not able to facilitate that at the moment. But what we do a lot of is help researchers with their work. So whether that's either answering inquiries over the phone or over email, or actually inviting people to the archive where they can spend a couple of days going through the records, depending on the nature of their inquiry and the size of the inquiry. So there's certainly different ways that we can work those sorts of requests, and we're very happy to do so.
I have to ask, is this a whiskey archive as well as a historical archive?
Yes, we do have a fantastic bottle collection as well, which goes over two rooms. So we have a malt collection and also a blended whiskey collection, as well as also our whiskey brands like Crown Royal and Bushmills. So we do have bottles going back to the 1900s. With liquids still in them that are on display, and we try to show the packaging evolution throughout the years. So you'll have bottles of Johnnie Walker going from the 1900s, when it was then Old Highland Whiskey, right the way through to the current day.
Are you looking for new material to add to the collection? If somebody in Scotland had something of historical interest, or that they thought might be of historical interest, or literally anywhere where Diageo is making drinks, do you look for new material to add to the archive?
Yeah, always. Every day we are looking for new things to add, and there's so much being produced that for us to keep on top of it is actually quite a timely job. So people often get in touch with us and to say that they've found things in their house and would we like them for the archive. We would love people to get in touch if they think they do have anything that might be of historical use to the Diageo archive.
How would somebody get in touch with you if they had something like that?
I would ask them just to either give us a phone or to email us. So I can certainly give you my contact details if that would be helpful.
Okay, we'll get those and we'll make them available. If someone has something that they think might be worthwhile for the Diageo archives, they can reach me at WhiskeyCast and I'll give them your information and pass that along. Thank you very much for talking with me, Joanne. We're talking now with Carol Bennett, the Visitors Center Manager, the Brand Home Manager, as it's referred to within Diageo, at Oban. Tell me what's going on around town this week to celebrate the 200th anniversary of Oban.
Well, there's a real buzz around the town of Oban at the moment. There's quite a large program of events. There's plays going on in the local Corran Halls. We've had a royal visit from Princess Anne today, and she was invited to attend a bicentenary lunch with many of the dignitaries of the town. She also visited the Oban War and Peace Museum today. We're also holding a world-breaking attempt to try and beat the record for the largest Arcadian strip, the Willow, and that's happening on Saturday.
And that's a dance, a traditional Highland dance that we should explain, right?
It's a traditional Scottish Highland dance, yes, which is very energetic and great fun. We've also had a town's procession today with the local Oban Pipe Band and many of the sort of local school children and organisations from around the town having a procession along to the Corran Halls where the Royal Princess was welcoming them. And we also have the tall ships coming. I think they're sailing from Greenock, I think it may be. I think there's quite a number of tall ships going to be in Oban Bay next Saturday, or this Saturday coming.
Tell me about the role the distillery plays in the town today, because as we've said a couple of times, Oban literally grew up around the Oban Distillery.
Yeah.
What role do you play in the town today?
Well, we are a key employer for the area. We're one of the the biggest industries in Scotland. You know, whisky production is one of the biggest industries in Scotland, and obviously we play a part in the local economy of the town of Oban. We employ operators to make the whisky, but also we have quite a large staff of people that are involved in the tourism side, which is taking visitors around the distillery that want to learn about the product and the brand. And just the fact that we're in the heart of the town, I think we play a part in many aspects of the local community as well. We get involved in a lot of community events, we do a lot of charitable sponsorship and things like that, and we're often used as a venue for events as well.
And you're the major tourist site in Oban, obviously, as well, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And we have over 35,000 visitors coming each year to the distillery from all over the world. And so we're very busy with that.
But Princess Anne didn't come by, did she?
Well, Princess Anne has visited Oban Distillery twice. She opened the original visitor centre back in the 1980s, and she reopened the visitor centre after a key refurbishment in the 90s. So I think we were on the list of possible venues to visit, but I think because she's seen us before and obviously been to visit us before, I think it was felt it would be nice for her to visit somewhere else. But we'd have loved to welcome her.
I have to ask, will there be a special commemorative bottling of Oban to celebrate the town's anniversary?
At this time, no. It was decided not to do that, but we have got a new special bottling out this year, which we're very excited about. It's called the Oban Distillery Bottling, and it's a cask strength edition of Oban from a Mantilla Fino sherry cask, and it is only available here at the distillery. So we're delighted to have that, and I guess you could almost say that's our special bottling for this year.
Tell me about living in Oban, because I know you live there year round, right?
Yes. Well, it's a lovely place to live. I'm just actually back from holiday from Southern Ireland, and it's very similar to that area. It's a beautiful part of the world to live in. Very picturesque, right on the water. Oban is quite a vibrant town, so although we're quite remote in terms of our location in Scotland, there's a lot happening in Oban itself, and you know, there's lots of good facilities here. I have young children, and there's lots for them to do and participate in. The downside, I guess, is the Scottish weather. We do have a very wet climate. We don't get a lot of snow, but it is very wet. But of course, that's very important for us for making whiskey. We need plenty of water.
We're not going to complain about rain in Scotland as long as it goes to making whiskey.
Exactly. It's very important for us.
But you're not so remote that tourists can't get to you fairly easily if they want to visit Oban. You're on the main highways from Glasgow. It's, if I remember correctly, it's maybe, an hour to an hour and a half west of Glasgow, or 2 hours?
Yes, it's about two and a half hour drive from Glasgow, but we're very accessible. You can come to Oban by ferry, you can come to Oban by seaplane, you can drive to Oban, you can get the bus or the train to Oban. So yeah, it's very accessible from Glasgow, and also quite easily to get to from Edinburgh as well. And even something you could do as a day trip, you could drive from Glasgow or Edinburgh to Oban for the day, and then make your journey on somewhere else. The one other thing I should say about Oban is the gateway to the islands. So there are Caledonian McBrain ferries, which can take you from Oban out to lots of the West Coast islands, places like Isla, Mull, Colonsay, and even further afield. So if people are coming to Oban, you know, they can make that step onto the islands as well from here.
Is Oban the only distillery that you've worked at, or have you worked at others?
No, I've actually grown up in the whiskey industry. My father worked, and my grandfathers and my uncles all worked in the whiskey industry. I'm originally from Speyside, so I lived at distilleries growing up, because at that time, distillery operators worked shifts, as they do now. And because they worked shifts, it was a good idea for them to live at the distilleries. So the distilleries had company houses. So basically, I grew up in distilleries, and the distilleries were almost my playground when I was a child.
Which distilleries?
Well, when I was born, I lived at Balmenich Distillery, which is on Speyside. And then I moved, when I was just before high school, I moved to Glenore Distillery. And I lived there for quite some time. And then I moved to a small distillery on Speyside called Bill Ewan, which is part of our company still. And I worked for some competitors' distilleries when I was a student in Speyside. And I also worked at Dalwhinnie and came to Oban when I was 21 after I graduated. And I've been here 15 years.
What's it like growing up at a distillery?
Well, it was a very small community. I think there was something like 22 houses in Balmenich, and you know, everybody worked and lived together. So it was a very tight-knit community. People helped each other out. People knew each other's business, I suppose, to a degree. But it was always a very supportive thing. And I suppose for me, it's just been a way of life. I don't, you know, consider it strange or different. It's just how I grew up. But it was a really nice, secure, safe, enjoyable childhood that I had.
Where were you told not to go when you were growing up?
I was told not to go to the dam. Most distilleries in Scotland have a dam or a reservoir where the water supply is kept. So obviously that was out of bounds because it was quite deep. But apart from that, pretty much we got to play in the grounds of the distillery. I can remember when I was a kid, the casks used to be lined up before they were filled. And that was a great climbing frame for us. But I think things have changed slightly now with health and safety, and obviously it's slightly different nowadays. I'm showing my age now.
Not as much fun for the kids of the distillery managers now, because usually it's only the managers that live on site, right?
Yes. Distillery manager. There used to be two big houses. One was always the distillery manager's house, and the other one was the customs and excise officer's house, because, again, years ago they would have stayed on site. So, yes, probably now it's more likely just to be the distillery manager's house. And here at Oban, we're very unique because the building, the distillery manager's flat, is part of the distillery building itself. So, as I speak to you, I'm sitting in the distillery manager's office, and right above my head is his house. That's where he lives. It's a pretty unique.
I have to ask, growing up at a distillery, did the kids of the distillery workers and the kids of the gaugers hang out together? Was there a rivalry there? Did the excise officers, did you just stay away from the excise officers' kids?
I think, coming on for 40, I'm 39, and to be honest, although there was still the two big houses in the distilleries, the customs and excise officers weren't there constantly in my day. But I guess further than that, they must have definitely lived and worked and played together, I'm sure.
Like most of Diageo's distilleries, Oban doesn't have its own website. You can find out more about visiting Oban at malts.com or discoveringdistilleries.com. There are links to both sites at the WhiskeyCast website. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with a couple of older Oban releases. I have to admit, these wound up in a dark corner of my office a while back when I was cleaning the place, and I rediscovered them this week. The Oban 18-year-old was released in 2008 in limited amounts, but you might still be able to find it here and there. It's bottled at 43% ABV. The nose is dry and spicy with nutmeg, hazelnut, and a nice touch of oak campfire smoke. The taste is rich and luscious with a honey sweetness balancing out brine and a hint of seaweed with touches of peat and allspice. It's a complex and well-balanced combination. The finish is long, smooth, and warm. If you see this one anywhere, jump on it. I'm scoring the Oban 18 a 94. Oban is also a popular fixture in the Classic Malts Distillers Edition series, and the 1993 edition was finished in Pheno sherry casks. Like the 18, it's bottled at 43% ABV. The nose is sweet and caramel thick with a muted touch of toffee. The taste is sweet, thick, and full of caramel, toffee, and a subtle touch of dates. The finish is sweet and lingering with a slight brininess. I'm scoring the Oban 1993 Distiller's Edition a 91. Now, Bailey Nickel Jarvie is a blended scotch that's not sold in the U.S., but I picked up some recently in Scotland. It's bottled at 40% and claims to have the highest malt content of any blended scotch. That's probably a pretty good claim. Maltiness dominates my notes on this one. The nose is malty and honey sweet with oak and a touch of rubber cement. The taste starts off with malt, honey, and a nice spiciness, followed by a sudden and unpleasant blast of sour apples. Now that fades quickly, which is a good thing, and the taste turns slightly smoky with a nice maltiness. The finish is dry with the maltiness that carries over off the tongue and lingers pleasantly. The key here is to add a lot of water. It gets rid of the unpleasant elements and smooths things out with a nice smoky spiciness. However, there are enough rough spots on this one that I can't give Bailey Nickel Jarvie much more than 76 points. You'll find all of my tasting notes in the free WhiskeyCast smartphone apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The Apple version is sponsored by the Glenrothes, and the Android version is sponsored by Ben Romick. They're also available at the WhiskeyCast website, and that's also where you'll find links for the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, WhiskeyCast HD episodes, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.